Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. Go over to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, this is the last time I'm going to say this, Chad. Make sure you click on that Here We Still Stand live stream banner so that you can get registered for the live stream that is coming up October 16th and 17th. Two-day event, all online. It's free. Costs you nothing. When I say get registered, I literally just mean type your name and email address into a form, and then we'll send you links at the appropriate time. That's all it takes. And you can join us for the Here We Still Stand live online conference. Also, if you're sitting there right now listening to this, you can also whip out your phone while you're listening, go to Amazon, type in Unveiling Mercy, and you can hit that pre-order for Chad's book. We don't know. Every single one of you might have already done this because they don't give us numbers for the pre-order. So we don't know. I mean, I might be talking to no one. Every single one of you might be like, guys, I already did it. I don't know. But if you haven't, now's the time. Christmas is coming. My kid informed me that I can't remember how many days it was, but it was less days than I thought it was away just the other day. So you can get those Christmas presents ordered. Nothing like a devotional in the Hebrew for everyone that you know. So get that all done. Chad, we are in 1 Samuel 14. So we got a long chapter that we're going to try to make our way through with a bunch of weird stuff in it.
Yeah, we have a lot of weird stuff coming up here. We've got some crazy oath that Saul makes. We got Jonathan, who ends up being like a really, really good warrior. And then we have some strange like people eating meat with blood in it. And Saul almost puts Jonathan to death. I mean, there's a lot of strange happenings in 1 Samuel 14. And it is a long chapter, 52 verses. So we got quite a bit to cover here. So
have you noticed this about the Old Testament and the New Testament, but particularly in the Old Testament? Here is something you can learn from the Old Testament. Don't make oaths. Just don't do it.
Let your yes be yes and your no be no.
Yeah, this is not good. Like, don't make the oaths, man. Like, we've seen now numerous times where people have made oaths that were ill-advised and just don't do it.
Yeah, because chances are you're going to get your kid in trouble.
I feel like this is what Jesus is thinking of. Recurring pattern.
Yeah, Jesus. Probably so.
He's thinking about dudes making oaths about sacrificing the first thing out their door. He's thinking about old 1 Samuel 14, and Jesus says, just let your yes be yes and your no be no. This oath business has not went well historically.
No, it has not. Yeah, so we will get to this particular oath a little ways into the chapter. So What's gonna go down, basically, just kind of give you a, let me give you a big picture view here. So Jonathan and his armor bearer are going to attack some Philistines, and it's gonna go really well. Philistines are gonna freak out, and then the Israelites are gonna start to pursue some of the Philistines. And it turns out that some of the Israelites had actually gone over to the side of the Philistines, like outlaws. So we're gonna see what happens to them. Jonathan gets hungry, eats some honey. Saul said, nobody's supposed to eat anything. And in the end, it's a question of what's going to happen when the lots, the Urim and Thummim, are cast. We got to figure out what's going to happen when Jonathan is the one chosen by lot. So anyway, that's kind of an outline what we're coming up to. Well, it begins with Jonathan deciding that he's going to do something about the Philistines. So Jonathan has his armor bearer, his servant who's with him, and he says to his armor bearer, tell you what, let's cross over to the garrison of the Philistines that's on the other side. But he did not tell his father.
Now, and just to recap, you have to remember that they are facing down what seems like an insurmountable opposition here, which is probably why you have some defectors that were like, you know what? Now is a good time to switch sides.
Yeah, he had some opportunists there. He were like, I'm not liking these odds. So I think I'm going to join the Philistines, the uncircumcised Philistines for a little while. Yeah, things are not looking good for Saul. I mean, you kind of get the feel from not just this chapter, but the previous chapter. It's like you just pick up these little hints that things are gradually collapsing all around Saul. I mean, we're going to get to his collapse in the next episode. in chapter 15. But you're already picking up on a lot of pretty strong hints that things are not going to work out well for the first king of Israel. And we're going to see more of this in this chapter. Saul just can't seem to get his act together. It's like there's always something going wrong with him. Either something happens or he does something wrong, or his men desert him and things just gradually begin to fall apart for him. So in this particular case, we start out with a focus on Jonathan. And this particular story kind of sets the father and son at odds, both directly and indirectly. Indirectly in the sense that if there's any hero in this particular story, it's certainly not Saul. I mean, he kind of comes across in many ways as a buffoon. But Jonathan comes out as this daring, gallant, really good warrior who basically thinks that his dad has made a huge mistake and has led to all sorts of problems for the rest of the troops. So anyway, Jonathan says to his armor bearer, this young servant, he says, let's go over. There's a Philistine garrison over there. He didn't tell his father. We're told that he didn't tell his father, because that's going to become significant a little bit later in the story. So they sort of, I guess they're just going to take matters into their own hands. They're going to sneak off and see what they can do. So Saul is staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate. For some reason, and I can't quite figure it out, I even researched this. The ESV translates it under the pomegranate cave or something like that. Yeah, it's just, but it's the pomegranate tree in Hebrew. So I don't know why they have cave there, but depending on the translation you're using, you'll see something about a pomegranate, probably a tree. Anyway, so he's staying there. It's close to this place called Migron, right outside Gibeah. And he's got 600 guys with him. So this is what you were talking about earlier, Dan. He's only got 600 men. He started out with about 2,000. And so his troops have just been hemorrhaging, losing them left and right. They're deserting him. Now he's got 600, and that's it. So 600 was Saul. And he's also got a priest with him. This is the first time we've met this guy. But we know his grandfather. So he's got Ahijah, the son of Ahituv, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. So Ahijah is the grandson of Eli. You remember Eli from several episodes ago. Of course, that's how 1 Samuel starts out. Eli's the priest. Samuel is taken under him. He kind of becomes Eli becomes sort of Samuel's adopted father. He's raising him there at the tabernacle. Eli dies when news comes back that the Ark of God has been taken, as do his two sons. So this is his grandson, Ahijah. And he is there. He's the new priest of the Lord. I guess maybe he's the high priest. We're not told that, but he's probably the high priest. And he was wearing an ephod. You got to keep this. All these details are significant because the ephod is going to come up a little bit later when we have to decide, when we have to cast lots. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So nobody knows at this point that Jonathan is armor bearer on this secret mission to attack the Philistine garrison. How are they going to get there? Well, they take this really dangerous route. It says, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistine garrison, there were a couple of real sharp crags. It's like the Hebrew there is like a tooth crag, I guess, like, you know, just like teeth stick out. So these were sticking out on either side. And they're even, I guess these were so well known that they gave names to both of these rocky outcroppings. One was named Bozez and the other was named Sineh, which means shining and thorny. So this was evidently a well-known place. You got this real steep drop-off between them. And it's not a place, the reason this geography is important is this is not a place where the Philistines would have expected someone to come from, right? So the one rises on the north and the one rises on the south. So we're at verse 5 now. Verse 6, Jonathan says to the young man who was carrying his armor, come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. It's a pretty good, I would say, pretty good theological statement. First of all, he says, you know, perhaps. He says perhaps, not because he doubts the Lord's ability to give him success. The perhaps is, listen, I don't know the will of God, right? And I'm about to engage in a very very difficult maneuver, trying to get to where the enemy's at. And perhaps the Lord will work for us. Because you know what? Numbers don't matter to God. The Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. Can the Lord save his people with an army of 10,000? Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Can the Lord save his army with one angel? Yeah. Yeah. He did that much later in the time of Isaiah, right? When he just basically wiped out the whole Assyrian army with one angel. Or you have, you know, David later on, one guy, a kid, armed with a sling, and they have this this battle of one warrior against another warrior, and he ends up taking out the Philistine warrior, takes out Goliath. So God can save his people by many or by few. And in this case, there's going to be two of them, Jonathan and his armor bearer.
Yeah, I mean, this is why thy will be done is like the best statement of faith. It's like it's a statement that does two things. It says that God is sovereign, and that you are not. It is putting your trust in God while not being presumptuous that you know everything that he knows, or that you know even what it is that he is or isn't going to do, right? So this perhaps is not at all doubt. It's like actually it's actually much different than doubt. It's knowing the difference between you and God.
Yeah, yeah. And this occurs, this isn't the only place this Hebrew word occurs. It occurs in several of the context where the will of the Lord is uncertain. You know, a standard theological rule of thumb is that if God has promised something unconditionally, then you pray for it unconditionally.
Yep.
If God has promised you unconditionally forgiveness and peace and hope and all of these things. And so you don't pray, Lord, if it is your will, give me love.
Right.
You don't pray, Lord, if it is your will, give me forgiveness. No, you ask for that without any conditions because God has promised it unconditionally. But if he's promised something conditionally, that is, you don't know for sure if he's going to give it to you, like healing of body, or, you know, protection from danger, all that kind of stuff, keeping you, you know, from getting injured or whatever it might be, then yeah, you pray, thy will be done. There's a lot of, most of life is praying, thy will be done, because most of life we're saying, perhaps, we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But we do know that God's not restrained by many or by few. He can do that which he wants because he is God.
Yeah. Yeah. God's will is sometimes unknown, but his power is not. So he certainly has you pray knowing he has the power to do whatever it is that you're asking. Mm-hmm. The only question is this what he wills to do? But yeah, I mean, some people even say, you know, the things that God has promised, and you see people do this in the scriptures all the time, you can almost demand that God do certain things once he has locked himself up with his word.
Yes. Yeah. 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 We have a great example of that in, you know, the mother of the Syrophoenician mother.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. She's praying for mercy. Yeah. You can demand mercy from God. In the sense of, you know, you can say, you never say, Lord, if it is your will, have mercy.
No, you say, Lord, have mercy.
You said, Lord, have mercy.
It's not even a statement with a question mark on the end of it. Lord, have mercy? No. There's a period on the end of that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So Jonathan is not sure. So he says, perhaps, maybe he will. And his armor bearer said to him, it's a little bit... A little bit strange in the Hebrew here, so you'll see this translated a little bit differently depending on which one you're using, but mine has, do all that is in your heart, turn yourself. That's the confusing part, that translation of that verb for turn yourself. And here I am with you according to your heart, or like your heart. Basically what he's saying is this, whatever's in your heart, go ahead and do that. And I am with you like your heart's with you. The Septuagint, the Greek translation, has it something like, I don't have it here in front of me. I looked at it earlier this morning, something like, as is your heart, so is my heart.
Yeah.
Something like that. But I mean, the point he's making is basically, I'm with you no matter what. You know, if your heart is leading you to this, that is to say, if your heart is the epicenter of your being. So if the epicenter of your being, if who you are is leading you to do this, then yeah, I'm with you where you go. It's kind of a Ruth kind of moment, right? Where you go, I will go. Yeah. So his armor bearer is basically telling him that whatever you want to do, I'm with you. His armor bearer kind of says, you know, like what your will is, that's going to be my will. So here's verse 8, Jonathan's going to kind of lay out his plan. He says, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to cross over to where these guys are at, these Philistines, and we're going to reveal ourselves to them.
And that's when this guy checked out. That's when I was with you right up until then.
Wait, he's like, wait, we're going to do what?
Like, I'm with you. My heart is with you. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to cross over and then we're going to show ourselves. Okay, see, like that was, okay, my heart has now fled.
Yeah, I was with you until you said that. So that's the first part of the plan. We're going to kind of sneak over there and then we're going to show ourselves. And then verse 9, they're going to say one of two things. So if they say, wait, and we will come to you, then we're going to stand where we're at and we're not going to go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, because the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us. Now, this is a little strange to me, just because having said all that about Jonathan and the perhaps thing, he seems to be kind of laying down like, okay, God, here's what I want you to do. You know, depending on what they say, I'm going to put the fleece out. Like Gideon.
Yeah.
So if they say this, if they say we're coming to you, then evidently God is not really in my plan, you know. But if they say come up to us, then that's going to be God's sign to us. How did Jonathan know that?
I don't know. I guess he's like, well, if they come after us, we know it's not God's plan and we run. Right. If they say come to us, then well, we have to go with this is God's plan, because we're gonna be the ones making the move.
Yeah, I guess that's what he's thinking. So, and it, by the way, this is sort of a, I don't know that this is necessarily intended, but it is kind of a cool thing in the Hebrew. It's almost a play on Jonathan's name. So Jonathan's name in Hebrew would be pronounced either Yehonatan or Yonatan. So the Yaho or Yo is short for Yahweh, the Lord. And the Yehonatan, the Natan part of that is where we get names like Nathan. But Natan means to give. So Jonathan's name, Yehonatan, means the Lord has given. And he says here, if they say, come up to us, then we're going to go up because the Lord has given them into our hands. So Jonathan is, whether purposely or inadvertently, is making a play on his own name. So Jonathan says, if they say, come up to us, then they've been Jonathaned into our hands. Well, you can probably forecast what is actually going to happen. Verse 11, they both reveal themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines seem to be mocking them here. They're like, oh, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've hidden themselves. Look, here come the cavemen, right?
Yeah, yeah. Look at these Hebrew prairie dogs out there.
Yeah, look, the Hebrew prairie dogs have shown their heads. They're coming out of the caves. And then they continue the mocking. The men of the garrison, they call out to Jonathan and his armor bearer. And I don't like the translation I'm using here. It renders it a little bit too literally. It says, come up to us and we will tell you something. Well, the first part is fine, come up to us, but the we will tell you something kind of has the feel of like, come here, we're going to teach you a lesson. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's kind of the feel of this.
The ESV says, come up to us and we will show you a thing.
Yeah, there you go.
It seems to me that what they're saying is, hey, come over here, we're going to show you a little something.
Yeah, that's it. That captures the essence of it. So it's the Hebrew there is a verbal form of like cause someone to know, but it kind of has the, given the context, it's kind of like, yeah, we're going to show you a little thing.
Yeah,
just come on up to us.
We got a little something for you.
Yeah, that's it. Come on up here, prairie dogs. We're going to show you a thing or two. Well, of course, this was exactly what Jonathan had laid down as the sign, right? If they said, come up, then this is the sign. So they climb up. This is, remember, they're climbing like up this sharpie precipice. So it says they climb up on their hands and their feet. So they're just, you know, they are looking like prairie dogs, I suppose. They're crawling, they're all like animals. And his armor bearer is behind him. And then when the battle begins, it says they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer put some of them to death as well. And in fact, that slaughter, verse 14, was one in which Jonathan and his armor bearer killed about 20 guys in a small space. It says, literally, it's within half a furrow in an acre of land, which I suppose is just the Hebrew way of saying it's a pretty small area where these guys were at. But the main point is, listen, it's 20-2. These are not good odds, you know, but Jonathan and, or maybe there were more, but they killed 20 of them anyway. So this particular small isolated incident is the pebble in the pond. We're going to have the ripple effect after this. So Jonathan and his armor bearer, because of course God is with them, because the Lord is giving these Philistines into their hands, they have a great success. And yeah. Verse 15 is fascinating because it says there was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. Literally, so that it became a trembling from God, or a panic from God. It's fascinating because you have this kind of language in a lot of different places, both in prose and poetry, but you have it all over the place in some of the Psalms where like David is talking about this great victory that God gives. And it's like the earth is cooperating, right? You have all like stars are falling from the sky. The earth is shaking. The ground is splitting apart. I mean, some of this is like exaggerated, hyperbolic, poetic language in the Psalms where he's describing how the earth is involved in this appearance of God. But you also have things like this happening in a lot of other prose context where there's some kind of battle that takes place, but creation is, as it were, cooperating with God and with his army, because all sorts of things start to happen, like hailstones fall on the enemies, or hear the ground quakes. Of course, then you have the most monumental with, like, you know, the sea splitting or the earth opening up to swallow up Korah and his rebels. So there's all sorts of kind of creational things happening when you have these battles taking place as well. Now, interestingly, here's a little bit of a intertextuality for you. So the relationship between two different texts. I was looking at this particular verse, and I wondered if that verb translated here as quaked, if it had occurred anywhere else, or, you know, any significant context. So I did a word search on it. And I found this. Fascinatingly, if you go back to the book of Exodus, chapter 15, remember this is right after they've crossed the sea. This is the song at the sea. So if you look at Exodus 15, verse 14, it says this. So this is the song at the sea right after they crossed. The peoples have heard, they tremble. That's the same verb that's used here in 1 Samuel. But notice who trembles. It says, anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Isn't that interesting? So all the way back at the crossing of the Red Sea, when they sang that song and used that same verb for trembling or quaking, it was connected to the people of the Philistines. Now we skip forward generations to 1 Samuel 14. And once more, who's quaking? Who's trembling? Well, the inhabitants of Philistia. So that's a cool way you'll see sometimes see two narratives that really don't seem to have a whole lot in common linked together by use of the same verb.
You know, of all the enemies of Israel that we see, it does seem like the Philistines are the enemy that is most fearful of the God of Israel. Like they we've talked about this before, but they absolutely seem to believe that he is a real thing. They've experienced some things that would lead them to that, to believe that. And so, you know, if you're like, yeah, if we just saw two guys saunter in there and just start wiping guys out, you start to wonder, like, oh my gosh, are these people's God? Is he coming out to battle for them again?
Again, yeah. They probably are thinking that. I mean, that's a great point to make, too. They do seem to be, in a odd sort of way, they seem to be the most theologically akin to the Israelites in that way. I mean, of course, they're worshiping different gods, but they actually have respect for the God of Israel. And probably because of, well, even before they captured the Ark. But I guarantee you the whole Ark story, that was something that fathers told their sons and those sons told their sons. That got passed down. Like, beware of messing with the God of the Israelites because of what happened to us.
They probably also think, I mean, this is just true because this is the way God is. God is unlike you would ever think God is. And so obviously all your false gods behave exactly the way that you assume they behave because you created them. I imagine the Philistines have really tried to figure out this God of Israel and they can't do it, right? And neither can we. Because this God is so unlike all the other gods, they're like, we can't figure this God out at all. Like, he seems so unknowable. And, you know, in a lot of ways, this God seems unpredictable. Like, I mean, sometimes he comes out, sometimes he doesn't. Like, we can't determine how to avoid God. You know, sometimes he doesn't show up and then we like have these big victories. And then sometimes two guys come and wipe out a bunch of people. And this is very inconsistent.
Yeah, this is the Philistines' painful way of learning the theology of the cross, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the backwards sort of ways that God likes to work. I guess we'll keep moving on here. We have this trembling taking place. Everybody's scared. And then this is happening among the Philistines, but Saul's people find out about it too. So Saul's got these spies in Gibeah, and they see everything that's going on. They see the multitudes melting away. They're going this way. They're going that way. So Saul knows something's happened, right? Why are all these Philistines taking off? So Saul says to his people that they need to figure out who's not there. Number us and see who has gone from us. So they had some kind of system whereby they could, you know, figure out pretty quickly who was there and who wasn't. And when they numbered them all, did their roll call or whatever they did, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So of course he knows, my son, he's responsible for this. Then we have this strange episode. Saul says to Ahijah is the priest, so the grandson of Eli. He says, bring the Ark of God here. Okay, bad idea. I mean, this is, you talked about the oaths earlier. You know, they should know by now that bringing the Ark of God, not a good move.
Hey, Samuel is still alive. And last time, we did this without asking Samuel if this was a good idea. It was not a good idea. So yeah. Saul,
not a good idea here either.
Saul just blew it with Samuel. It's sort of unfathomable that he is making this move without saying, what he should be saying right now is, bring Samuel here. I got a question to ask him.
Yeah. That's it. He's conspicuously absent from this whole chapter. So he's not there. They got the Ark. But what another part that kind of that's strange about this is, so he says, bring the Ark of God here. Okay. The Ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. Should not have been, but it was. But the Ark kind of fades from the story because what's going on is he really wants the priest to cast lots. Because he goes on and says, so Saul's talking to the priest, and then there's a commotion in the camp of the Philistines. It just keeps increasing. It continues. So into verse 19 has this kind of a brief statement that needs some explanation. He says to the priest, withdraw your hand. Withdraw your hand from what? Well, I think what's going on here is this. So Saul called Ahijah the priest. He's like, okay, I need to know the will of God here. What do I do? You know, do I stay here? Do I attack? What do I need to do? So he says, and this is admittedly speculation, but I'm speculating on the basis of these few words. But I think what he said was, we need to determine the will of the Lord. So why don't you cast lots for me? Why don't you pull out the Urim and Thummim and tell me what I'm supposed to do? And then when he's about to do that, things are thrown into such confusion that he says, withdraw your hand. That is to say, don't worry about it. Don't cast lots. We just need to act now. This is the only time, if my reconstruction of that is right, this is the only time in the scriptures where basically you stop a priest halfway through casting lots.
Yeah.
To say, nope, we just need to move on. We got it. We don't have any time to determine the will of the Lord. We just need to go. So what happens? Well, Saul and all the people who were with him rallied. They came to the battle. And it says that every man's sword was against his fellow. That echoes what happened in Judges 7, when Gideon and his men, they hold up the torches, blow the trumpets, and the swords of the Midianites were turned against each other. Well, that's what's happened in here with the Philistines. Every man's swords turned against him. And it says there was a very great confusion. Now, I did a search of this particular phrase, very great confusion. It's three words in Hebrew, three words in English, occurs only here and one other place. Back in chapter 5, verse 9, when the Ark of God was brought into one of the cities of the Philistines, there was very great confusion. So I think this is the case where the author is wanting us to link these two episodes together. God caused confusion back in chapter 5 when they brought the Ark of God into one of the Philistine cities. And now, what's more, God is causing a very great confusion among the Philistines because he is going out to battle with his Israelites. Verse 21, the Hebrews. Now, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, now, these are the outlaws that I mentioned earlier. They also went up with them all around in the camp. Even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So these are the guys who had,
some real flip-floppers here. They see the tide turning. They're like, well, like, that's...
You change uniforms right quick. Let me put on my Israelite uniform once more, right? Yeah, so they keep flipping and flopping back and forth. And all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim, they heard that the Philistines had fled, and so they pursued them in battle also. And the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Avon. So everything at this point really seems to be going fairly well, right? Jonathan is armor bearer. They have this great victory over the garrison of the Philistines, and then Saul and his army, well, they rally, and some of the guys who had deserted them, they come back around to their side. Some of the guys who were in hiding, they come out, and everybody's chasing the Israelites. Now, I mean, everybody's chasing the Philistines. Now, this should have been great.
Yeah, I'm not a prophet, priest, or king, Chad, but I feel like this is the moment where you make a sacrifice, you take the win, and go home.
Yeah, that would have been probably smart. But as you might suspect, that's not what happens. Verse 24 says, the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day. Well, why were they hard-pressed? Well, because Saul, here's our oath, Saul had put the people under oath, saying, and this just makes no sense. Here's the oath, cursed be the man who eats food before evening and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food.
Yeah, this isn't the smartest thing. Like if I now, okay. So every time I go to go play basketball, if I know I'm going to go play basketball for a couple of hours, I eat a peanut butter Snickers and a banana. Now that's for the carbs, the sugar, and the potassium. So that your muscles don't cramp up, and so you have energy and calories to burn. I assume if I'm about to go into battle, like not eating anything all day is not the way. It's not. Yeah. It just doesn't seem like a wise move.
No, no. You play basketball. I run. So like my Wednesday mornings are my long run. So I ran 10 miles last week. Now the day before, I ate more food than usual. You know, if you're running a long race, eat a lot of food the day before, you carb up, right?
Yeah.
Because you know
you're about to burn it all,
pushing your body to the extreme the next day. So I have never pursued Philistines. Nor have I ever been a soldier in battle, but I would assume that it's the same thing, right? If you want to have energy, you need to be eating. The last thing you need to be doing is fasting during a battle.
No, man, you got to hit that protein bar.
Yeah, you eat your Snickers. But this is another one of these cases, just like Jephthah that we talked about, you know, back in Book of Judges and his foolish oath that he swore. This is another foolish oath. And we'll see as the story goes on exactly why, how foolish it was. So what happens next? Well, the people, they enter the forest. There's honey on the ground. I guess kind of a strange episode, but honey's dripping evidently from some honeycombs. And no man ate any of it because, of course, they're afraid of the oath. Jonathan, he didn't know about it. So he's got his staff in his hand. He reaches down and he puts some on in the honeycomb and puts it to his, you know, his mouth and says his eyes brightened. You know, he was hungry, right? And the honey helped. He made it. It was a practical, realistic decision. There was no reason for Jonathan not to do this. But one of the people said, Jonathan, your dad strictly put the people under oath saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. And I love Jonathan's response. This is verse 29. Jonathan makes no excuses. He says, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. The Hebrew verb akar, which is used there for troubled, that takes us all the way back to the book of Joshua. Remember how Achan had troubled Israel and he was stoned and buried and it was called the Valley of Achor. So Jonathan says here of his dad, yeah, well, you know what? My dad has made trouble for the land. You should taste some honey just like I did. So anyway, that's the whole, the breaking of the oath part. So moving on, verse 31, they strike down the Philistines and they pursue them all the way to kind of the Philistine border. And it says the people were weary, understandably so. So they end up rushing upon the spoil and they're taking some sheep and some oxen and some calves and they're slaughtering them. And they're not slaughtering so as to drain all the blood. So when they're eating the meat, they're actually eating the meat with the blood, which we all know from Genesis 9 and from Leviticus is a huge, huge taboo in the Old Testament.
Yeah, these guys got to be real hungry. They're coming, like the sun has gone down. They come up on some cattle and they just start hacking it into steaks, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they could be eating some of this raw, you know, it's not unheard of for hunters to do that. And so maybe they're, you know, they're taking a bite out of the heart. Who knows what they're doing, but they're eating the animals without the blood drain. So Saul, after he's uttered his foolish oath, now he's all worried because the people are sinning against the Lord. And so he takes this great stone. It's going to make an altar all of a sudden. And he says to the people, hey, bring the animals here and slaughter it here. Don't sin against the Lord by eating the meat with the blood. So the people brought their animals to him and he slaughtered it there. And everything, I suppose, was kosher after that. So Dan, are we going to be able to finish this?
I don't think we're going to make it.
Man, I thought we were going to make it. Are we going to have to leave everybody hanging?
It looks that way.
I mean, I'm looking ahead here. We've got a significant portion coming up here where we have to cast lots and we got to figure out who's guilty and who's innocent. And we might just have to leave that until next time.
We might have to. Yeah. So, I mean, so we have to leave here where Saul has made an altar. It does say that this was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So this is a new thing for him, right?
Yeah, it is. In fact, it's almost a Pentateuchal kind of statement, right? I talk about how Abraham built an altar, Isaac built an altar, Jacob built an altar. Now Saul builds an altar to the Lord. And you kind of wrap up here, but you know, Saul is a strange character because he'll utter these. It's almost like he is pious, but in a in a wrong sort of way. Like he makes this oath, you know, no one can eat until God has given us victory. And he's all worried about the guys eating the blood with the meat. But at the same time, he's almost foolishly pious, because the oath that he makes ends up hurting his own people and jeopardizes his son later on. So,
well, you're not eating the meat with the blood in it if you didn't make the oath that no one's supposed to eat anything.
Right. Yeah.
And what this all comes down to is God didn't tell him to make that oath. I mean, God did not, this oath was not instructed by God. So this is just and we see this. I mean, we talk about like, there is such a thing as coming up or inventing your own piety. There's nothing pious about doing things that sound godly that God hasn't said to do.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, that was one of the complaints of the Reformation, right?
Yeah.
There were all of these invented acts of piety in the medieval church that were thought actually to like earn divine merit, earn divine grace, and they weren't commanded by God. So beware of falsely creating your own methods of piety, especially thinking that somehow God is going to be pleased when you do that, because we learned from the case of Saul that that is not so.
In fact, you might feign some piety and end up actually committing some sin.
Yes, right. Well, I'm sorry, everybody. We were going to get through this, but ends up being 52 verses is a little bit longer, a little bit too much. So stay tuned,
guys. Next week, of course, we'll be live, not talking about this, talking about something else, something altogether different. The live recording of 40 Minutes, which is how the Here We Still Stand conference starts out. So on Friday, if you want to join us live, all you have to do is sign up, and you can hang out with Chad and Eric and I as we do something special for Here We Still Stand, and then we'll be back in it the following week to find out how the rest of this shakes down. Chad, I will see you next week
in person. Yeah, see you then.